ably maintained by Nicholas Humphrey, David Primack, 1986, and others, that chimpanzees are natural psychologists, what I would call second-order intentional systems, capable of adopting the intentional stance towards other things. This is not surprising if our own innate equipment includes a theory of mind module, as Leslie, Baron Cohen, and others have maintained, for perhaps this is part of the endowment chimpanzees and we inherit from a common ancestor. But even if chimpanzees are, like us, innately equipped as natural psychologists, they nevertheless lack a crucial feature shared by all human natural psychologists, folk and professional varieties. They never get to compare notes. They never dispute over attributions and ask to know the grounds for each other's conclusions. No wonder their comprehension is so limited. Ours would be, too, if we had to generate it all on our own. Let me sum up the results of this rather swift survey. Our human brains, and only human brains, have been armed by habits and methods, mind tools and information, drawn from millions of other brains which are not ancestral to our own brains. This, amplified by the deliberate, foresightful use of generate and test in science, puts our minds on a different plane from the minds of our nearest relatives among the animals. This species-specific process of enhancement has become so swift and powerful that a single generation of its design improvements can now dwarf the R&D efforts of millions of years of evolution by natural selection. Comparing our brains anatomically with chimpanzee brains, or dolphin brains, or any other non-human brains, would be almost beside the point. Because our brains are, in effect, joined together into a single cognitive system that dwarfs all others, they are joined by an innovation that has invaded our brains and no others. Language. I am not making the foolish claim that all our brains are knit together by language into one gigantic mind, thinking it's transnational thoughts, but rather that each individual human brain, thanks to its communicative links, is the beneficiary of the cognitive labors of the others in a way that gives it unprecedented powers. Naked animal brains are no match at all for the heavily armed and outfitted brains we carry in our heads. This fact reverses the burden of proof in what would otherwise be a compelling argument. The claim, first considered by the linguist Noam Chomsky, 1975, and more recently defended by the philosophers Jerry Fodor, 1983, and Colin McGinn, 1991, that our minds, like those of all other species, must suffer cognitive closure with regard to some topics of inquiry. Spiders can't contemplate the concept of fishing. Birds, some of whom are excellent at fishing, aren't up to thinking about democracy. What is inaccessible to the dog or the dolphin may be readily grasped by the chimp, but the chimp in turn will be cognitively closed to some domains we human beings have no difficulty thinking about. Chomsky and company ask a rhetorical question. What makes us think we are different? Aren't there bound to be strict limits on what Homo sapiens may conceive? According to Chomsky, all matters of human puzzlement can be sorted into problems, which can be solved, and mysteries, which cannot. The problem of free will, Chomsky opines, is one such mystery. The problem of consciousness, according to Fodor, is another, and McGinn concurs. As the author of books, 1984, 1991A, that claim to explain each of these impenetrable mysteries, I can be expected to disagree, but this is not the place to pursue such issues. Since neither Chomsky nor Fodor thinks he himself can explain free will or consciousness, the claim that it is humanly impossible is doctrinally convenient for them, perhaps, but also in considerable tension with another claim of theirs. In other moods, they have both correctly hailed the capacity of the human brain to parse and hence presumably understand, the official infinity of grammatical sentences of a natural language such as English. If we can understand all the sentences, in principle, couldn't we understand the ordered sets of sentences that best express the solutions to the problems of free will and consciousness? After all, one of the volumes in the Library of Babel is, must be, the best statement in fewer than 500 pages of short grammatical English sentences of the solution to the problem of free will. And another is the optimal job in English on consciousness. I dare say neither of my books is either of those, but that's life. I can't believe that Chomsky or Fodor would declare either of those books, or the trillions of runners-up, to be incomprehensible to a normal English reader. So perhaps they think that the mysteries of free will and consciousness are so deep that no book, of any length, in any language, could explain them to any intelligent being. But that claim has absolutely no evidence in its favor to be derived from any biological considerations. It must have, fallen from the sky. Consider the closure argument in more detail. What is closed to the mind of a rat may be open to the mind of a monkey, and what is open to us may be closed to the monkey. McGinn, 1991, page 3. Monkeys, for instance, can't grasp the concept of an electron, McGinn reminds us, but I think we should be unimpressed by the example. For not only can the monkey not understand the answers about electrons, it can't understand the questions. Dennett, 1991d. The monkey isn't baffled, not even a little bit. We definitely understand the questions about free will and consciousness well enough to know what we're baffled by, if we are. So until Chomsky and Fodor and McGinn can provide us with clear cases of animals or people who can be baffled by questions whose true answers could not unbaffle them, they have given us no evidence of the reality or even likelihood of cognitive closure in human beings. Their argument is presented as a biological, naturalistic argument, reminding us of our kinship with the other beasts, and warning us not to fall into the ancient trap of thinking how like an angel we human souls are with our infinite minds. But it is, in fact, a pseudo-biological argument, one that, by ignoring the actual biological details, misdirects us away from the case that can be made for taking one species, our species, right off the scale of intelligence that ranks the pig above the lizard and the ant above the oyster. We certainly cannot rule out the possibility, in principle, that our minds will be cognitively closed to some domain or other. In fact, as we shall talk about in more detail in Chapter 15, we can be certain that there are realms of no doubt fascinating and important knowledge that our species, in its actual finitude, will never enter. Not because we will butt our heads against some stone wall of utter incomprehension, but because the heat death of the universe will overtake us before we can get there. This is not, however, a limitation due to the frailty of our animal brains, a dictate of naturalism. On the contrary, a proper application of Darwinian thinking suggests that if we survive our current self-induced environmental crises, our capacity to comprehend will continue to grow by increments that are now incomprehensible to us. Why shouldn't Chomsky and Fodor and McGinn love this conclusion? It grants to human minds, and only to human minds, an indefinitely expanding dominion over the puzzles and problems of the universe, with no limits in sight. What could be more wonderful than that? The trouble is, I suspect, that they deem the means to be unsatisfactory. If the mind's power is due to cranes, not skyhooks, they would just as soon settle for mystery. That attitude, at any rate, has often surfaced in these controversies, and Chomsky has been a primary source of authority for it. 2. Chomsky contra Darwin. 4 episodes. Chomsky, one might think, would have everything to gain by grounding his controversial theory about a language organ in the firm foundation of evolutionary theory. And in some of his writings, he has hinted at a connection. But more often, he is skeptical. Steven Pinker, 1994, page 355. In the case of such systems as language or wings, it is not easy even to imagine a course of selection that might have given rise to them. Noam Chomsky, 1988, page 167. A sizable gulf in communication still exists between cognitive scientists who entered the field from AI, or from the study of problem-solving and concept-forming behavior on the one side, and those who entered from a concern with language on the other. When the uniqueness of language processes as a human faculty is emphasized, as it has been by Chomsky, the gulf becomes wider. Herbert Simon and Craig Kaplan, 1989, page 5. On September 11, 1956, at MIT, three papers were presented at a meeting of the Institute for Radio Engineers. One was by Alan Newell and Herbert Simon, 1956, The Logic Theory Machine. And in it they showed, for the first time, how a computer could prove non-trivial theorems of logic. Their machine was the father or grandfather of their general problem solver, Newell and Simon, 1963, and the prototype for the computer language Lisp, which is to artificial intelligence roughly what the DNA code is to genetics. The Logic Theory Machine is a worthy rival of Art Samuel's Checkers program for the honor of AI Adam. Another paper was by the psychologist George A. Miller, The Magical Number 7, Plus or Minus 2, which went on to be one of the classic papers inaugurating the field of cognitive psychology. Miller, 1956. The third paper was by a 27-year-old junior fellow at Harvard, Noam Chomsky, Three Models for the Description of Language, 1956. Retrospective coronations are always a bit arbitrary, as we have seen several times, but Chomsky's talk to the IRE is as good an event as any to mark the birth of modern linguistics. Three major new scientific disciplines born in the same room on a single day. I wonder how many in the audience had the sense that they were participating in a historic event of such proportions. George Miller did, as he tells us in his account, 1979, of that meeting. Herbert Simon's own retrospective view of the occasion has changed over the years. In his 1969 book, he drew attention to the remarkable occasion and said of it, on page 47, "Thus, the two bodies of theory, linguistics and artificial intelligence, have had cordial relations from an early date, and quite rightly, for they rest conceptually on the same view of the human mind. If only that were true." By 1989, he could see how the gulf had widened. Not many scientists are great scientists, and not many great scientists get to found a whole new field. But there are a few. Charles Darwin is one. Noam Chomsky is yet another. In much the way there was biology before Darwin, natural history and physiology and taxonomy and such, all united by Darwin into what we know as biology today, so there was linguistics before Chomsky. The contemporary scientific field of linguistics, with its sub-disciplines of phonology, syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, its warring schools and renegade offshoots, computational linguistics in AI, for instance, its sub-disciplines of psycholinguistics and neurolinguistics, grows out of various scholarly traditions going back to pioneer language sleuths and theorists from the Grimm brothers to Ferdinand de Saussure and Roman Jacobson. But it was all unified into a richly iterated family of scientific investigations by the theoretical advances first proposed by one pioneer, Noam Chomsky. His slender 1957 book, syntactic structures, was an application to natural languages such as English of the results of an ambitious theoretical investigation he had undertaken into yet another region of design space, the logical space of all possible algorithms for generating and recognizing the sentences of all possible languages. Chomsky's work followed closely in the path of Turing's purely logical investigations into the powers of what we now call computers. Chomsky eventually defined an ascending scale of types of grammars or types of languages, the Chomsky hierarchy, on which all students of computation theory still cut their teeth, and showed how these grammars were interdefinable with an ascending scale of types of automata or computers, from finite state machines through pushdown automata and linear bounded machines to Turing machines. I can vividly remember the shockwave that rolled through philosophy when Chomsky's work first came to our attention a few years later. In 1960, my sophomore year at Harvard, I asked Professor Quine what critics of his views I should be reading. I considered myself at the time to be an anti-Quinean of ferocious conviction, and was already beginning to develop the arguments for my senior thesis attacking him. Anybody who was arguing against Quine was somebody I had to know about. He immediately suggested that I should look at the work of Noam Chomsky, an author few in philosophy had heard of at the time, but his fame soon engulfed us all. Philosophers of language were divided in their response to his work. Some loved it and some hated it. Those of us who loved it were soon up to our eyebrows in transformations, trees, deep structures, and all the other arcana of a new formalism. Many of those who hated it condemned it as dreadful, Philistine scientism, a clanking assault by technocratic vandals on the beautiful, unanalyzable, unformalizable subtleties of language. This hostile attitude was overpowering in the foreign language departments of most major universities. Chomsky might be a professor of linguistics at MIT, and linguistics might be categorized there as one of the humanities, but Chomsky's work was science, and science was the enemy, as every card-carrying humanist knows. Sweet is the lore which nature brings, our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Wordsworth's romantic view of the scientist as murderer of beauty seemed perfectly embodied by Noam Chomsky, automata theorist and radio engineer. But it is a great irony that he was all along the champion of an attitude towards science that might seem to offer salvation to humanists. As we noted in the previous section, Chomsky has argued that science has limits, and in particular, it stubs its toe on the mind. Discerning the shape of this curious fact has long been difficult, even for those who can handle the technicalities and controversies of contemporary linguistics. But it has long been marveled at. Chomsky's notorious review, 1959, slamming B.F. Skinner's verbal behavior, 1957, was one of the founding documents of cognitive science. At the same time, Chomsky has been unwaveringly hostile to artificial intelligence, and has been so bold as to entitle one of his major books, Cartesian Linguistics, 1966, almost as if he thought the anti-materialistic dualism of Descartes was going to come back in style. Whose side was he on, anyway? Not on Darwin's side, in any case. If Darwin dreaders want a champion who is himself deeply and influentially enmeshed within science itself, they could not do better than Chomsky. This was certainly slow to dawn on me. In March 1978, I hosted a remarkable debate at Tufts, staged, appropriately, by the Society for Philosophy and Psychology. Nominally a panel discussion on the foundations and prospects of artificial intelligence, it turned into a tag-team rhetorical wrestling match between four heavyweight ideologues, Noam Chomsky and Jerry Fodor attacking AI, and Roger Schenck and Terry Winograd defending it. Shank was working at the time on programs for natural language comprehension, and the critics focused on his scheme for representing, in a computer, the higgledy-piggledy collection of trivia we all know and somehow rely on when deciphering ordinary speech acts, elusive and truncated as they are. Chomsky and Fodor heaped scorn on this enterprise, but the grounds of their attack gradually shifted in the course of the match, for Shank is no slouch in the bully-baiting department, and he staunchly defended his research project. Their attack began as a straightforward first principles condemnation of conceptual error. Shank was on one fool's errand or another, but it ended with a striking concession from Chomsky. It just might turn out, as Shank thought, that the human capacity to comprehend conversation, and more generally to think, was to be explained in terms of the interaction of hundreds or thousands of jerry-built gizmos. But that would be a shame, for then psychology would prove, in the end, not to be interesting. There were only two interesting possibilities in Chomsky's mind. Psychology could turn out to be like physics, its regularities explainable as the consequences of a few deep, elegant, inexorable laws, or psychology could turn out to be utterly lacking in laws, in which case the only way to study or expound psychology would be the novelist's way, and he much preferred Jane Austen to Roger Shank, if that were the enterprise. A vigorous debate ensued among the panelists and audience, capped by an observation from Chomsky's colleague at MIT, Marvin Minsky. I think only a humanities professor at MIT could be so oblivious to the third interesting possibility. Psychology could turn out to be like engineering. Minsky had put his finger on it. There is something about the prospect of an engineering approach to the mind that is deeply repugnant to a certain sort of humanist, and it has little or nothing to do with a distaste for materialism or science. Chomsky was himself a scientist, and presumably a materialist. His Cartesian linguistics did not go that far. But he would have no truck with engineering. It was somehow beneath the dignity of the mind to be a gadget or a collection of gadgets. Better the mind should turn out to be an impenetrable mystery, an inner sanctum for chaos, than that it should turn out to be the sort of entity that might yield its secrets to an engineering analysis. Though I was struck at the time by Minsky's observation about Chomsky, the message didn't sink in. In 1980, Chomsky published Rules and Representations as a target article in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, and I was among the commentators. The contentious issue, then and now, was Chomsky's insistence that language competence was largely innate, not something that a child could properly be said to learn. According to Chomsky, the structure of language is mostly fixed in the form of innately specified rules, and all the child does is set a few rather peripheral switches that turn him into an English speaker instead of a Chinese speaker. Chomsky says the child is not a sort of general-purpose learner, a general problem-solver, as Newell and Simon would say, who must figure out what language is and learn to engage in it. Rather, the child is innately equipped to speak and understand a language, and merely has to rule out certain very limited possibilities and rule in certain others. That's why it is so effortless, according to Chomsky. For even slow children learn to speak. They aren't really learning at all, any more than birds learn their feathers. Language and feathers just develop in species ordained to have them, and are off-limits to species that lack the innate equipment. A few developmental triggers set the language acquisition process in motion, and a few environmental conditions subsequently do some minor pruning or shaping into whichever mother tongue the child encounters. This claim has encountered enormous resistance. But we can now be sure that the truth lies much closer to Chomsky's end of the table than to that of his opponents. For the details, see the defenses of Chomsky's position in Jackendoff 1993 and Pinker 1994. Why the resistance? In my BBS commentary, which I presented as a constructive observation, not an objection, I pointed out that there was one reason to resist this that was perfectly reasonable, even if it was only a reasonable hope. Just like the biologist's resistance to Hoyle's howler, the hypothesis that life didn't begin on Earth but began somewhere else and migrated here, the psychologist's resistance to Chomsky's challenge had a benign explanation. If Chomsky was right, it would just make the phenomena of language and language acquisition that much harder to investigate. Instead of finding the learning process going on before our eyes in individual children, where we could study it and manipulate it, we would have to pass the buck to biology and hope that the biologists could explain how our species learned to have language competences built in at birth. This was a much less tractable research program. In the case of Hoyle's hypothesis, one could imagine arguments that fixed a maximal speed of mutation and selection and showed that there had not been enough time on Earth for the whole process to have occurred locally. Chomsky's arguments, from the poverty of the stimulus and the speed of language acquisition, are analogous. They purport to show that there must have been large gifts of design in the infant if we are to explain the speedy development of the mature competence. And while we can take solace in the supposition that we may someday be able to confirm the presence of these innate structures by direct examination of the nervous system, like finding fossils of our extraterrestrial ancestors, we will have to accept the disheartening conclusion that a larger portion than we had hoped of learning theory, considered in its most general form as the attempt to explain the transition from utter ignorance to knowledge, is not the province of psychology at all, but rather of evolutionary biology at its most speculative. Dennett, 1980. To my surprise, Chomsky missed the point of my commentary. Whereas he himself had offered reflections on what would make psychology interesting, he couldn't see how there might be something disheartening to psychologists in the discovery that they might have to pass the buck to biology. Years later, I finally realized that the reason he didn't see what I was driving at was that although he insisted that the language organ was innate, this did not mean to him that it was a product of natural selection, or at least not in such a way as to permit biologists to pick up the buck and analyze the way in which the environment of our ancestors had shaped the design of the language organ over the eons. The language organ, Chomsky thought, was not an adaptation, but a mystery, or a hopeful monster. It was something that perhaps would be illuminated someday by physics, but not by biology. It may be that at some remote period a mutation took place that gave rise to the property of discrete infinity. Perhaps for reasons that have to do with the biology of cells, to be explained in terms of properties of physical mechanisms now unknown. Quite possibly other aspects of its evolutionary development again reflect the operation of physical laws applying to a brain of a certain degree of complexity. 1988, page 170. How could this be? Many linguists and biologists have tackled the problems of the evolution of language, using the same methods that have worked well on other evolutionary puzzles and getting results, or at least what seem to be results. For instance, at the most empirical end of the spectrum, work by neuroanatomists and psycholinguists has shown that our brains have features lacking in the brains of our closest surviving relatives, features that play crucial roles in language perception and language production. There is a wide diversity of opinion about when, in the last 6 million years or so, our lineage acquired these traits, in what order and why. But these disagreements are as amenable to further research, no better and no worse off, than disagreements about whether the Archaeopteryx flew, for instance. On the purely theoretical front, and casting the net much more widely, conditions for the evolution of communication systems in general have been deduced. For example, Krebs and Dawkins, 1984, Zahavi, 1987. And the implications are being explored in simulation models and empirical experiments. We heard in Chapter 7 some of the ingenious speculations and models that have been directed at the problem about how life bootstrapped itself into existence. And there is a similar bounty of clever ideas about how language must have got going. There is no question that the origin of language is theoretically a much easier problem than the origin of life. We have such a rich catalog of not-so-raw materials with which to build an answer. We may never be able to confirm the details, but if so, this will not be a mystery but only a bit of irreparable ignorance. Some particularly abstemious scientists may be reluctant to devote time and attention to such far-flung exercises in deductive speculation, but that does not appear to be Chomsky's position. His reservations are directed not to the likelihood of success, but to the very point of the enterprise. It is perfectly safe to attribute this development of innate language structures to natural selection, so long as we realize that there is no substance to this assertion, that it amounts to nothing more than a belief that there is some naturalistic explanation for these phenomena. Chomsky, 1972, page 97. There have long been signs, then, of Chomsky's agnosticism, or even antagonism, towards Darwinism, but many of us have found them hard to interpret. To some, he appeared to be a crypto-creationist, but that didn't seem very plausible, especially since he had the endorsement of Stephen Jay Gould. Remember the linguist J. Kaiser's appeal to Gould's term, spandrel, to describe how language came to be? Kaiser probably got his terminology from his colleague Chomsky, who got it from Gould, who in turn has avidly endorsed Chomsky's view that language didn't really evolve, but just rather suddenly arrived. An inexplicable gift, at best a byproduct of the enlargement of the human brain. Yes, the brain got big by natural selection, but as a result of this size and the neural density and connectivity thus imparted, human brains could perform an immense range of functions quite unrelated to the original reasons for increase in bulk. The brain did not get so big that we could read or write or do arithmetic or chart the seasons. Yet human culture, as we know it, depends upon skills of this kind. The universals of language are so different from anything else in nature, and so quirky in their structure, that origin as a side consequence of the brain's enhanced capacity, rather than as a simple advance in continuity from ancestral grunts and gestures, seems indicated. This argument about language is by no means original with me, though I ally myself fully with it. This line of reasoning follows directly as the evolutionary reading for Noam Chomsky's theory of universal grammar. Gould, 1989b, page 14. Gould stresses that the brain's growth may not have been due initially to selection for language, or even for heightened intelligence, and that human language may not have developed as a simple advance in continuity from ancestral grunts, but it does not follow from these suppositions, which we may grant him for the sake of argument, that the language organ is not an adaptation. It is, let us grant, an exaptation, but exaptations are adaptations. Let the remarkable growth of the hominid brain be a spandrel, in whatever sense Gould or Kaiser wishes, and still the language organ will be as much an adaptation as the bird's wing. No matter how suddenly the punctuation occurred that jogged our ancestors abruptly to the right in design space, it was still a gradual design development under the pressure of natural selection, unless it was indeed a miracle or a hopeful monster. In short, although Gould has heralded Chomsky's theory of universal grammar as a bulwark against an adaptationist explanation of language, And Chomsky has in return endorsed Gould's anti-adaptationism as an authoritative excuse for rejecting the obvious obligation to pursue an evolutionary explanation of the innate establishment of universal grammar. These two authorities are supporting each other over an abyss. In December 1989, the MIT psycholinguist Steven Pinker and his graduate student Paul Bloom presented a paper, Natural Language and Natural Selection, to the Cognitive Science Colloquium at MIT. Their paper, which has itself subsequently appeared as a target article in Behavioral and Brain Sciences, laid down the gauntlet. Many people have argued that the evolution of the human language faculty cannot be explained by Darwinian natural selection. Chomsky and Gould have suggested that language may have evolved as the byproduct of selection for other abilities, or as a consequence of as yet unknown laws of growth and form. We conclude that there is every reason to believe that a specialization for grammar evolved by a conventional neo-Darwinian process. Pinker and Bloom, 1990, page 707. In one sense, Pinker and Bloom said, page 708, our goal is incredibly boring. All we argue is that language is no different from other complex abilities, such as echolocation and stereopsis, and that the only way to explain the origin of such abilities is through the theory of natural selection. They arrived at this incredibly boring conclusion by a patient evaluation of various analyses of multifarious phenomena that show beyond a reasonable doubt, surprise, surprise, that the language organ must indeed have evolved many of its most interesting properties as adaptations, just as any neo-Darwinian would expect. The response from the audience at MIT was anything but boring, however. Chomsky and Gould had been scheduled to reply, so there was a standing room only crowd. The level of hostility and ignorance about evolution that was unabashedly expressed by eminent cognitive scientists on that occasion shocked me. In fact, it was reflecting on that meeting that persuaded me I could no longer put off writing this book. So far as I know, no transcript of that meeting exists. The commentaries in BBS include some of the themes raised at the meeting, but you can recover something of the flavor by contemplating Pinker's list from Personal Communication of the 10 most amazing objections he and Bloom have fielded since drafts of their paper began to circulate. Versions of most of them, if memory serves me, were expressed at the MIT meeting. 1. Color vision has no function. We could tell red from green apples using intensity cues. 2. Language is not designed for communication at all. It's not like a watch. It's like a Rube Goldberg device with a stick in the middle that you can use as a sundial. 3. Any argument that language is functional could be made with equal plausibility and force when applied to writing in sand. 4. The structure of the cell is to be explained by physics, not evolution. 5. Having an eye calls for the same kind of explanation as having mass, because just as the eye lets you see, mass prevents you from floating into space. 6. Hasn't that stuff about insect wings refuted Darwin? 7. Language can't be useful. It's led to war. 8. Natural selection is irrelevant, because we now have chaos theory. 9. Language couldn't have evolved through selection pressure for communication, because we can ask people how they feel without really wanting to know. 10. Everyone agrees that natural selection plays some role in the origin of the mind, but that it cannot explain every aspect. Thus, there is nothing more to say. Are Gould and Chomsky responsible for the bizarre convictions of some of their supporters? This question has no simple answer. More than half of the items on Pinker's list have a clear ancestry in claims that have been made by Gould, numbers 2, 6, and 9 in particular, and Chomsky, Numbers 4, 5, and 10 in particular. Those who make these claims, including the others on the list, typically present them on the authority of Gould and Chomsky. See, for example, Otero, 1990. As Pinker and Bloom say, 1990, page 708, Noam Chomsky, the world's greatest linguist, and Stephen Jay Gould, the world's best-known evolutionary theorist, have repeatedly suggested that language may not be the product of natural selection. Moreover, two important dogs that haven't barked? I have yet to witness either Gould or Chomsky attempting to correct these howlers when they arise in the heat of battle. As we shall discover, this is everybody's weakness. I regret that the siege mentality among sociobiologists has led them to overlook, at any rate neglect to correct, more than a few cases of egregiously bad reasoning by members of their own team. One of Darwin's most enthusiastic supporters was Herbert Spencer, coiner of the phrase, the survival of the fittest, and an important clarifier of some of Darwin's best ideas, but also the father of social Darwinism, an odious misapplication of Darwinian thinking in defense of political doctrines that range from callous to heinous. Was Darwin responsible for Spencer's misuse of his views? Opinions differ on this. For my part, I excuse Darwin from the truly heroic task of chastising his champion in public, even though I regret that he wasn't more energetic in pursuing private acts of dissuasion or correction. Both Gould and Chomsky have been vigorous proponents of the view that intellectuals are responsible for the applications and likely misapplications of their own work. So presumably, they are at least embarrassed to find themselves cited as the sources of all this nonsense, for they themselves do not hold these views. It is perhaps too much to expect their gratitude to me for doing their dirty work for them. 3. Nice tries. In studying the evolution of mind, we cannot guess to what extent there are physically possible alternatives to, say, transformational generative grammar. For an organism meeting certain other physical conditions characteristic of humans, conceivably there are none, or very few. In which case, talk about evolution of the language capacity is beside the point. Noam Chomsky, 1972, page 98. To make progress in understanding all this, we probably need to begin with simplified, oversimplified, models, and ignore the critic's tirade that the real world is more complex. The real world is always more complex, which has the advantage that we shan't run out of work. John Ball, 1984, page 159. The problem here is how to get the pendulum to stop swinging back and forth so destructively. Time and again, we see the same failure of communication. The truly unfortunate communication gap that Simon and Kaplan speak of, in their quotation at the beginning of the previous section, is the amplified effect of a relatively simple bit of initial misunderstanding. Recall the difference between reductionists and greedy reductionists. Chapter 3, Section 5. Reductionists think everything in nature can all be explained without skyhooks. Greedy reductionists think it can all be explained without cranes. But one theorist's healthy optimism is another theorist's unseemly greed. One side proposes an oversimple crane, at which the other side scoffs, Philistine reductionists, declaring, truthfully, that life is much more complicated than that. Bunch of crazy skyhook seekers, mutters the first side, in defensive overreaction. That is what they would mutter if they had the term. But then again, if both sides had the terms, they might be able to see what the issues really were and avoid the miscommunication altogether. That is my hope. What are Chomsky's actual views? If he doesn't think the language organ is shaped by natural selection, what account does he give of its complexities? The philosopher of biology Peter Godfrey Smith, 1993, has recently focused on the family of views that maintain, in one way or another, that there is complexity in the organism in virtue of complexity in the environment. Since this was one of Herbert Spencer's pet themes, Godfrey Smith proposes we call any such view Spencerian. Spencer was a Darwinian, or you could say that Charles Darwin was a Spencerian. In any event, the modern synthesis is Spencerian to its core, and it is the Spencerism of that orthodoxy that is most often attacked in one way or another by rebels. Manfred Eigen and Jacques Monod are both Spencerian, for instance, in their insistence that it is only through environmental selection that molecular function can be specified. Chapter 7, Section 2, Chapter 8, Section 3. Whereas Stuart Kaufman's insistence that order emerges in spite of environmental selection expresses an anti-Spencerian challenge, Chapter 8, Section 7. Brian Goodwin's denial, 1986, that biology is a historical science is another example of anti-Spencerism, since it is a denial that historical interactions with earlier environments are the source of the complexities to be found in organisms. Gould and Lewontin's 1979 brief dalliance with intrinsic bioplane that account for all but the minor trimmings of organism design is yet another. Chomsky's suggestion that it is physics, not biology or engineering, that will account for the structure of the language organ is as pure an anti-Spencerian doctrine as you could find. This explains his misconstrual of my friendly suggestion about passing the buck to biology. I was assuming, as a good Spencerian adaptationist, that genes are the channel through which the environment speaks, as Godfrey Smith puts it, whereas Chomsky prefers to think of the genes getting their message from some intrinsic, ahistorical, non-environmental source of organization. Physics, we may call it. Spencerians think that even if there are such timeless laws of form, they could impose themselves on things only through some selectional process or other. Evolutionary thinking is just one chapter in the history of Spencerian versus anti-Spencerian thinking. Adaptationism is a Spencerian doctrine, and so is Skinner's behaviorism, and so, more generally, is any variety of empiricism. Empiricism is the view that we furnish our minds with details that all come from the outside environment, via experience. Adaptationism is the view that the selecting environment gradually shapes the genotypes of organisms, molding them so that the phenotypes they command are some near optimal fit with the encountered world. Behaviorism is the view that what Skinner, 1953, especially pages 129 to 141, called the controlling environment is what shapes the behavior of all organisms. Now we can see that Chomsky's famous attack on Skinner was as much an attack on Skinner's Spencerian view that the environment shaped the organism as it was on the limitations of Skinner's model of how this shaping took place. Skinner proclaimed that one simple iteration of the fundamental Darwinian process, operant conditioning, could account for all mentality, all learning, not just in pigeons, but in human beings. When critics insisted that thinking and learning were much, much more complicated than that, he and his followers smelled skyhooks and wrote off the critics of behaviorism as dualists, mentalists, anti-scientific know-nothings. This was a misperception. The critics, at least the best of them, were simply insisting that the mind was composed of a lot more cranes than Skinner imagined. Skinner was a greedy reductionist, trying to explain all the design and design power in a single stroke. The proper response to him should have been, "Nice try, but it turns out to be much more complicated than you think." And one should have said it without sarcasm, for Skinner's was a nice try. It was a great idea which inspired, or provoked, a half century of hard-headed experimentation and model building, from which a great deal was learned. Ironically, It was the repeated failures of another brand of greedy reductionism, dubbed Good Old-Fashioned AI, or GOFAI, by Haugland, 1985, that really convinced psychologists that the mind was indeed a phenomenon of surprising architectural complexity, much too complicated for behaviorism to describe. The founding insight of GOFAI was Turing's recognition that a computer could be indefinitely complicated, but that all computers could be made from simple parts. Whereas Skinner's simple parts had been randomly mated stimulus-response pairings that could then be subjected, over and over again, to the selection pressure of reinforcement from the environment, Turing's simple parts were internal data structures, different machine states that could be composed to respond differentially to indefinitely many different inputs, creating input-output behavior of any imaginable sophistication. Which of these internal states were innately specified, and which were to be revised by experience, was something left to be investigated. Like Charles Babbage, Turing saw that the behavior of an entity need not be any simple function of its own history of stimulation, since it could have accrued huge amounts of design over the eons, which would permit it to use its internal complexity to mediate its responses. That abstract opening was eventually filled by GoFi modelers with contrivances of dazzling complexity that still fell comically short of producing human-style cognition. Today, the reigning orthodoxy in cognitive science is that yesterday's simple models of perception, learning, memory, language production, and language understanding are orders of magnitude too simple. But those simple models were often nice tries, without which we would still be wondering how simple it might, after all, turn out to be. It makes sense to err on the side of greedy reductionism, to try for the simple model before wallowing around in complexities. Mendel's simple genetics was a nice try, and so was the rather more complex beanbag genetics it became in the hands of population geneticists, even though it has often relied on such retrospectively outrageous oversimplifications that Francis Crick was tempted to kick it out of science. Graham Cairns-Smith clay crystals are a nice try, and Art Samuel's checkers player was a nice try. Much too simple, as we learned, but on the right track. In the earliest days of the computer, Warren McCulloch and W.H. Pitts, 1943, proposed a magnificently simple logical neuron from which neural nets might be woven. And for a while it looked as if perhaps they had broken the back of the brain problem. Certainly before they made their modest proposal, neurologists were desperately confused about how to think of the brain's activity. One has only to go back and read their brave flounderings in the more speculative books of the 1930s and 1940s to see what a tremendous lift neuroscience got from McCulloch and Pitts. They made possible such pioneers as Donald Hebb, 1949, and Frank Rosenblatt, 1962, whose perceptrons were, as Minsky and Papert soon pointed out, 1969, a nice try, but much too simple. Now, several decades later, another wave of more complicated but still usefully simple nice tries, flying the flag of connectionism, are exploring portions of design space left unexamined by their intellectual ancestors. The human mind is an amazing crane, and there is a lot of design work that has to have been done to build it, and to keep it working and up to date now. That is Darwin's Spencerian message. One way or another, the history of environmental encounters over the eons and during the last 10 minutes has shaped the mind you have right now. Some of the work must have been done by natural selection, and the rest by one or another internal generate and test process of the sort we discussed earlier in the chapter. None of it is magic. None of it involves an internal skyhook. Whatever models we propose of these cranes will surely be too simple in one regard or another. But we are closing in, trying out the simple ideas first. Chomsky has been one of the leading critics of these nice tries, dismissing everyone from B.F. Skinner through such go-fi mavens and mavericks as Herbert Simon and Roger Schenck to all the connectionists. And he has always been right that their ideas have been too simple by far. But he has also exhibited a hostility to the tactic of trying for simple models that has unduly raised the temperature of the debates. Suppose, for the sake of argument, we grant that Chomsky could see better than anyone else that the mind and the language organ, which plays such a central role in its superiority over animal minds, are structures of a systematicity and complexity that beggar all models to date. All the more reason, one would think, to search for an evolutionary explanation of these brilliant devices. But although Chomsky uncovered for us the abstract structure of language, the crane that is most responsible for lifting all the other cranes of culture into place, he has vigorously discouraged us from treating it as a crane. No wonder yearners for skyhooks have often taken him as their authority. He is not the only candidate, however. John Searle is another favorite champion of skyhook seekers, and he is certainly no Chomskyan. We noted in Chapter 8, Section 4, that Searle has defended a version of John Locke's mind-first vision under the banner of original intentionality. According to Searle, automata, computers or robots, don't have real intentionality. At best, they have mere as-if intentionality. Moreover, original or real intentionality cannot be composed of, derived from, or presumably descended from, mere as-if intentionality. This creates a problem for Searle, because whereas artificial intelligence says you are composed of automata, Darwinism says you are descended from automata. It is hard to deny the former if you admit the latter. How could anything born of automata ever be anything but a much, much fancier automaton? Do we somehow reach escape velocity and leave our automaton heritage behind? Is there some threshold that marks the onset of real intentionality? Chomsky's original hierarchy of ever fancier automata permitted him to draw the line, showing that the minimal complexity of an automaton capable of generating the sentences of a human language puts it in a special class. Still a class of automata, but at least an advanced class. This was not quite enough for Chomsky. As we have just heard, he planted his feet and said, in effect, yes, language makes the difference, but don't try to explain how the language organ got designed. It's a hopeful monster, a gift, nothing that could ever be explained, an awkward position to maintain. The brain is an automaton, but not one we can reverse engineer. Is this perhaps a tactical mistake? According to Searle, Chomsky took one step too many before planting his feet. He should have denied that the language organ had a structure that could even be described in automaton terms at all. By lapsing into information processing talk, talk about rules and representations and algorithmic transformations, Chomsky had given a hostage to the reverse engineers. Perhaps Chomsky's heritage as a radio engineer is coming back to haunt him. Specifically, the evidence for universal grammar is much more simply accounted for by the following hypothesis. There is indeed a language acquisition device, LAD, innate in human brains, and LAD constrains the form of languages that human beings can learn. There is thus a hardware level of explanation in terms of the structure of the device, and there is a functional level of explanation, describing which sorts of languages can be acquired by the human infant in the application of this mechanism. No further predictive or explanatory power is added by saying that there is, in addition, a level of deep unconscious rules of universal grammar, and indeed, I have tried to suggest that that postulation is incoherent anyway. Searle, 1992, pages 244 to 45. According to Searle, the whole idea of information processing in the brain, described abstractly in terms of algorithms that exhibit substrate neutrality, is incoherent. There are brute, blind neurophysiological processes, and there is consciousness, but there is nothing else. Searle, 1992, page 228. That is certainly biting the bullet, and biting the same bullet as Chomsky, but in a somewhat different spot. Yes, of course, the LAD evolved, and so did consciousness. Searle, 1992, pages 88, and the pages directly following. But Chomsky is right that there is no hope of a reverse engineering account of either of them. Chomsky is wrong, however, to grant even the coherence of an automaton-level description of the process, for that opens the door to strong artificial intelligence. If Chomsky's position on the slippery slope is hard to maintain, Searle's has even more awkward consequences. He grants, as we heard in the passage quoted above, that there is a functional story to be told about how the brain does its work in language acquisition. There is also, he grants, a functional story to be told about how parts of the brain arrive at depth or distance judgments in vision. But there is no mental content whatever at this functional level. Searle, 1992, page 234. He then puts to himself the following quite reasonable retort from the cognitive scientists. The distinction between function talk and mental content talk does not really make much difference to cognitive science. We continue to say what we have always said and do what we have always done. We simply substitute the word functional for the word mental in these cases. This is, in fact, what Chomsky has often said in reply to such criticisms. See, for instance, 1980. To answer this retort, Searle, 1992, page 238, is obliged to take a step backwards himself. Not only is there no information processing level of explanation for the brain, he says, there is also really no functional level of explanation in biology. To put the point bluntly, in addition to its various causal relations, the heart does not have any functions. When we speak of its functions, we are talking about those of its causal relations to which we attach some normative importance. In short, the actual facts of intentionality contain normative elements. But where functional explanations are concerned, the only facts are brute, blind, physical facts, and the only norms are in us and exist only from our point of view. It turns out, then, that function talk in biology, like mere as-if intentionality talk, is not really to be taken seriously after all. According to Searle, only artifacts made by genuine conscious human artificers have real functions. Airplane wings are really for flying, but eagle's wings are not. If one biologist says they are adaptations for flying and another says they are merely display racks for decorative feathers, there is no sense in which one biologist is closer to the truth. If, on the other hand, we ask the aeronautical engineers whether the airplane wings they designed are for keeping the plane aloft or for displaying the insignia of the airline, they can tell us a brute fact. So Searle ends up denying William Paley's premise. According to Searle, nature does not consist of an unimaginable variety of functioning devices exhibiting design. Only human artifacts have that honor, and only because, as Locke showed us, it takes a mind to make something with a function. Searle insists that human minds have original intentionality, a property unattainable in principle by any R&D process of building better and better algorithms. This is a pure expression of the belief in skyhooks. Minds are original and inexplicable sources of design, not results of design. He defends this position more vividly than other philosophers, but he is not alone. The hostility to artificial intelligence and its evil twin, Darwinism, lies just beneath the surface of much of the most influential work in recent 20th century philosophy, as we shall discuss in the next chapter. Chapter 13. When generate and test, the basic move in any Darwinian algorithm, moves into the brains of individual organisms, it builds a series of ever more powerful systems, culminating in the deliberate, foresightful generation and testing of hypotheses and theories by human beings. This process creates minds that show no signs of cognitive closure, thanks to their capacity to generate and comprehend language. Noam Chomsky, who created contemporary linguistics by proving that language was generated by an innate automaton, has nevertheless resisted all evolutionary accounts of how and why the language automaton got designed and installed, and has also resisted all artificial intelligence attempts to model language use. Chomsky has stood firm against reverse engineering, flanked by Gould on the one side and Searle on the other, exemplifying the resistance to the spread of Darwin's dangerous idea, and holding out for the human mind as a skyhook. Chapter 14. In Chapter 8, I sketched an evolutionary account of the birth of meaning, which will now be expanded and defended against the skeptical challenges of philosophers. A series of thought experiments building on the concepts introduced in earlier chapters shows not just the coherence, but the inevitability of an evolutionary theory of meaning. Chapter 14. The Evolution of Meanings. 1. The Quest for Real Meaning. "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be the master? That's all." Lewis Carroll, 1871. There is no topic in philosophy that has received more attention than meaning in its multifarious manifestations. At the grand end of the spectrum, philosophers of all schools have grappled with the ultimate question of the meaning of life, and whether or not this question has any meaning. At the modest end,